Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, The Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning appointment, please call 919-779-1755. This program is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's musical questions come to us from Oxford Music Online and musicfeeds.com. Question number one, which of the following statements about musical instruments is true? Is it A, pianos only belong to the string family of instrument? Is it B, the violin and the fiddle are the exact same instrument? Is it C, saxophones are classified as a brass family of instrument? Or is it D, timpani instruments require a reed to make a musical sound? So what is truth here? And question number two, which is the most important instrument in a band? Is it A, the bass, B, drums, C, rhythm guitar, or D, piano? So which instrument is the most important instrumental to a band? The questions to these two important musical trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from the website onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of November the 13th. Well, it was 120 years ago today, 1900, that American composer Aaron Copland was born. Copland is known for such compositions as Appalachian Spring and Fanfare for the Common Man. Copland was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Peace in 1945. Aaron Copland, born on this day in 1900. And it was on this day back in 1937 that NBC formed the first full-size symphony orchestra exclusively for radio broadcasting. The conductor for the first 17 years was Arturo Toscanini. NBC Symphony Orchestra, 1937, today. And in country music news, we have this article entitled, Country Music's Unlikely Boom. This is written by Andrew R. Chow in Time magazine on the 16th of November, 2020. When the coronavirus hit the U.S., Gabby Barrett's breakout year was thrown into peril. The 20-year-old country singer-songwriter had just found her footing in Nashville with a steady rise of her fiery breakup single, I Hope. She planned to build on the momentum with a debut album and a global tour with country idol Brad Paisley. Instead, the tour was canceled, forcing Barrett into the longest break of her life. It was strange not being on the road, she says. It's pretty much all that I know. It looked as if country music itself were facing hard times. The scaling back of the physical spaces where the genre thrives, concert halls and bars, radio and concert tours, emphasized its vulnerability in the virtual realm, having long prided itself on resisting the technological changes that have transformed the music industry. Country risked falling even further behind hip-hop and pop, which dominate apps like TikTok and streaming services that now represent 80% of total music industry revenue. Barrett, for her part, settled into home life, soon to learn that she would be expecting her first child. Then something unexpected happened. I Hope exploded in popularity, topping the three major Billboard country charts and becoming the first debut single by a woman to top Billboard's country streaming songs chart. Meanwhile, the genre broke out at large, hitting a record number of streams for 3 weeks in a row, while pop, hip-hop, and Latin all sank below their baseline averages. iHeartRadio's country stations, too, rose 7.4% from winter to spring. Country's popularity has only grown during the pandemic. While the overall industry has risen only 2.6% on streaming services compared with its baseline pre-COVID numbers, country music has soared 15.8%, according to MRC data, Nielsen Music. Country music concerts have been among the first to spring back across the U.S. at varying levels of social distancing, while rising stars like Luke Combs, Morgan Wallen, and Barrett are racking up huge streaming numbers and crossing over into mainstream success. Country music has thrived, says Tom Pullman, iHeartRadio's chief programming officer. Experts suggest the reasons for this are both emotional and technological, as some listeners seek comfort for the soothing, nostalgic qualities of the genre, while others who previously disdained streaming platforms finally caved and subscribed. But while these factors might be temporary, they are also building a new foundation for country's digital era resurgence. Its fans' increasing willingness to engage on digital platforms, combined with its artist explorations beyond Nashville conventions of songwriting and sound, could move the genre back toward the center of mainstream consciousness. Because all these writers and singer-songwriters are stuck at home, I fully expect Nashville to start pumping out some of its best work in years, says Johnny Chiang, director of operations at Cox Media Group Houston, which includes country stations KKBQ and KTHT. Dvorak's Symphony No. 9 introduces our classical music news. It's entitled Thanksgiving Day, New World Weekend, November 26th through the 29th. This is put out by WQDR, the classical station's Crescendo magazine, November 2020 issue. As we look back on this eventful year, the gift of classical music is one thing for which we can all be thankful. As we gather together this Thanksgiving, count on the classical station to bring you a day full of beautiful musical selections to complement your family activities. Then stay tuned for our New World Weekend, when we'll present the best offerings of American composers and performers, including a new performance of Dvorak's Symphony No. 9, with Gianandrea Noseda leading the National Symphony Orchestra.
He broke my heart, and now it's raining just to rub it in. I'm at your door, I feel so crazy about it. You say I told you so, you saw it long ago.
You knew we had to go. I finally came around. I'm back on solid ground. Can't let it get me down.
Alicia Keys and John Mayer performing Lesson Learned introduce our Rhythm and Blues Music News. It's a review of Alicia Keys' latest release titled Alicia. And it's given 3 out of 4 possible stars in The Week magazine on the 2nd of October, 2020. Alicia Keys has made a career out of playing things straight down the middle, said Sal Cinquemani in SlantMagazine.com. It can't be a surprise, then, that the singer-songwriter's first album in 4 years strikes a happy balance between the R&B piano ballads that made her famous and the loosely experimental sound of 2016's Here. At times, when she steps away from the piano, the result is neo-soul formlessness that generously could be described as mood music. But when she stretches slightly, as on the dub-infused Wasted Energy, her musicality demands attention. Another highlight arrives with Time Machine, whose spacey funk is unlike anything Keys had ever recorded, said Andy Kellman in AllMusic.com. The album's most affecting moments arrive late, with a mother's lament about a senselessly murdered son, and a second ballad that salutes frontline health workers. Despite the honest emotion, Alicia remains Keys' most moderate work, seemingly hedged with an objective to appeal to as many listeners as possible.
Ain't perfect if you don't know what the struggle's for. Falling down ain't falling down if you don't cry when you hit the floor. It's called a past, cause I'm getting past, and I ain't nothing like I was before. You ought to see now.
My life, I'm a lot like you were. Oh man, look at my life, I'm a lot like you were.
Neil Young's Old Man introduces our research and technology news. It's an article entitled, When Does Someone Become Old? It's surprisingly hard to find a good term for people in late life. This is written by Joe Pinkster in The Atlantic magazine on the 27th of January, 2020. Once people are past middle age, they're old. That's how life progresses. You're young, you're middle aged, then you're old. Of course, calling someone old is generally not considered polite, because the word, accurate though it may be, is frequently considered pejorative. It's a label that people tend to shy away from. In 2016, the Marist poll asked American adults if they thought a 65-year-old qualified as old. 60% of the youngest respondents, those between 18 and 29, said yes. But that percentage declined the older respondents were. Only 16% of adults 60 or older made the same judgment. It seems that the closer people get to old age themselves, the later they think it starts. Overall, 2/3 of the Marist poll respondents considered 65 to be middle-aged or even young. These classifications are a bit perplexing, given that, well, old age has to start sometime. I wouldn't say 65 is old, says Susan Jacoby, the author of Never Say Die, the myth and marketing of the new old age, but I know it's not middle age. I mean, how many 130-year-olds do you see wandering around? The word old, with its connotations of deterioration and obsolescence, doesn't capture the many different arcs a human life can trace after middle age. This linguistic strain has only gotten more acute as average lifespans have grown longer, and especially for wealthier people, healthier. Older adults now have the most diverse life experiences of any age group. Ina Jaffe, a reporter at NPR who covers aging, told me in an email, some are working, some are retired, some are hitting the gym every day. Others suffer with chronic disabilities. Some are traveling around the world. Some are raising their grandchildren, and they represent as many as three different generations. There's no one term that conjure up that variety. So if 65-year-olds or 75-year-olds or 85-year-olds aren't old, what are they? As Jaffe's phrasing suggests, American English speakers are converging on an answer that is very similar to old, but has another syllable tacked on as a crucial softener. Older. The word is gaining popularity not because it is perfect, it presents problems of its own, but because it seems to be the least imperfect of the many descriptors English speakers have at their disposal. In general, those terms tend to be fraught or outmoded. Take senior, for example. Senior is one of the most common euphemisms for old people, and happens to be the one I hate the most, Jacoby told me. To her, senior implies that people who receive the label are different and somehow lesser than those who don't. The article skips down and ends with this.
Old friends, winter companions, the old men, lost in their overcoats, waiting for the sunset. The sounds of the city sifting through trees settle like dust on the shoulders of the old.
Simon and Garfunkel's Old Friends. Ideally, a definition of old age would capture a sense of things ending, or at least getting closer to ending. All those people who call 65 middle-aged aren't delusional. They probably just don't want to be denied their right to have ambitions and plans for the stretch of their lives that's still ahead of them, even if that stretch is a lot shorter than the one behind them. Susan Jacoby, the author of Never Say Die, suggested a definition of old age that addresses this elegantly. She told me that in her 20s she made lifelong friends, some of them 10 or 15 years older than she was, while working at the Washington Post. Now that she's 74, she comes across obituaries for those old friends. What I think of as old is an age when you start seeing people you know in the obituary column, she told me. I think of middle age as a time when you're not afraid to look at the obituaries because you assume that the people who have died, you're not going to know. Now, even if her definition doesn't help us figure out how to refer to others, it is poignant, personalized, and flexible, and will likely age well.
That's why birds do it, bees do it, even educated fleas do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love. In Spain, the best upper sets do it, Lithuanians, and let's do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love.
Alanis Morissette singing Let's Fall in Love introduces our pop music news. This is a review of her latest CD entitled Such Pretty Forks in the Road. It's given 2 out of a possible 4 stars by The Week magazine on August the 14th, 2020. It's been 8 years since Alanis Morissette's last album. But her way with words hasn't gone anywhere, said Laura Zuby in consequenceofsound.net. The Jagged Little Pill rocker is back with an immaculately polished 11-song set on which her targets include patriarchy and postpartum depression, and her caustic tongue remains singularly her own. Granted, there's little of the unshakable catchiness of some of Morissette's most beloved melodies, but catchiness doesn't feel like the most useful metric for judging this album. If the record is measured by its lyrics, there's plenty of drama and tension throughout, said Corey Groh in Rolling Stone. But after a solid opening track, Morissette quickly transitions to adult contempo schmaltz, bearing her most cutting lines in plinky, rhythmless, new-agey soundscapes that have more in common with that other 90s music juggernaut, Windham Hill. What's more, for all of its melancholy, Such Pretty Folks feels personal, but never profound.
Let's do it, let's do it, let's fall in love. Mosquitoes, heaven forbid, do it. So does every Katie Dean.
And in local music news, we have this from WQDR's Crescendo magazine, November 2020 issue, Thursday Night Opera House. Coming up on November 26, Richard Rogers, Oklahoma and South Pacific, Frederick Lowe's Gigi. Alfred Drake lends his operatic voice to Rogers and Hammerstein's Oklahoma and Lerner and Lowe's Gigi, while former Met star Ezio Pinza turns to Broadway in South Pacific. The Thursday Night Opera House airs every Thursday from 7 p.m. until 10 p.m. Eastern with Bob Chapman. For listening enjoyment, Bob emails a synopsis of each week's opera every Wednesday. So, how did you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, which of the following statements about musical instruments is true? Is it A, pianos only belong to the string family of instrument? Actually, they're a percussion family. And B, the violin and the fiddle are the same exact instrument? Actually, yes, that's true. Is it C, saxophones are classified as a brass family of instrument? Well, actually, they're a reed instrument. And D, timpani instruments require a reed to make a musical sound? Well, actually, what they require is a mallet. Correct answer, therefore, answer B. The violin and the fiddle are the exact same instrument. As noted in a 3/12/15 article in Oxford Music Online, even though the harp is Ireland's national symbol, the fiddle is the most commonly played instrument in traditional Irish music. Its ornamental melodies are more relaxed than the classical violin, and improvisation is encouraged. The fiddle has survived generational changes from its start as a low-class instrument popular among the poor. Now, the Irish fiddle is playing an instrumental role in preserving traditional Irish music and culture. Now, some will argue that while a violin is a fiddle, not every fiddle is a violin. Old-fashioned musicians prefer the word fiddle instead of violin to differentiate their music and their style of playing from other music. Here are some additional facts about the fiddle. Fiddles have been in existence as far back as the Middle Ages, but the modern fiddle did not gain popularity in traditional Irish music until around the 17th century. The word fiddle is a colloquial term used in traditional or folk music references. The fiddle thrived among rural populations in Ireland due to its low cost, low maintenance, and ease of use. The body of the fiddle is made of about 70 wooden components, and the bow is wound with horsehair. The Irish famine of 1845 to 1851 caused thousands of Irish natives to immigrate to the United States. At this time, many Irish musicians sought employment in minstrels and vaudeville shows to make decent money as fiddlers. Generally, most fiddlers play upbeat music you can dance to. Outside of traditional Irish dance music, the fiddle can be heard in New England's country dance, Western swing, and upbeat bluegrass music in the Upper South. And the answer to our second question, which is the most important instrument in a band? Is it the bass, the drums, the rhythm guitar, or the piano? Correct answer A. As noted in a 2/28/17 MusicFeeds.com article by Zanda Wilson, entitled Science Explains Why the Bass is the Most Important Instrument, a study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in America has revealed that the bass is the most important instrument in a band. In the study, researchers played a high-pitched and a low-pitched stream of music to subjects at the same time and found that those subjects were more easily able to process the rhythm of the low-pitched stream. It also found that people were much more likely to tap their feet or clap their along to songs with a prominent bass line, concluding that humans are simply designed to understand time in music better when it sits lower in the scale of tonality. The low voice superiority effect for encoding timing explains the widespread musical practice of carrying rhythm in bass-ranged instruments, concluded the study. Given the fractious times of this stressful year, let's close out today's program with some healing music. This is Anita Burrows on harp playing Cat Stevens' Morning Has Broken. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. This program is also available as a podcast after the broadcast in our website, ncreadingservice.org. As we leave you now, remember these words: kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. If you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me at 919-832-5138. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Music Review is underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning appointment, please call 919-779-1755. So long, until next time.